want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming to you through your computer, the internets, and your earbuds, all the way from San Francisco. Our program is supported by listeners. You can help. Just log on to peterbcollins.com. Lots of people have been generous, and if you're in a position to, go ahead and support the launch of our new podcast series. We have two fine writers on our program today. Coming up a little later, you will meet first-time novelist Lauren Farber. His new book is called Portage, and it's a novel set in Akron, Ohio, the home of Indians who used the portage there to carry their canoes from one river to another. He'll be with us a little bit later. Jerome Tuccilli is a widely published man, 25 books to his credit, and his latest is about the Gallo wine dynasty here in California, and it's called Gallo Be Thy Name. Jerry Tuccilli, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What got you interested in the Gallos?
Well, I'm always intrigued by these multi-generational family sagas. I did one years ago about the Hunt family and of Texas, and the more I studied the Gallos, the more I realized it was more than just a wine book. I mean, wine in itself is enough, but we're talking about a multi-generational family saga here going back 100 years, actually. It covers certainly well before Prohibition.
Oh, yeah.
And it was kind of a uniquely American saga. I mean, it's a successful business story. They've created a wine empire, but there's also true crime mixed in with it. There's mobsters, Prohibition, Al Capone. I mean, it's got all the elements that really get me excited. So
yeah.
The more I research, the more I realize I really wanted to write this book.
It is a fascinating story. And you have a business background. Your bio says you're a VP at T. Rowe Price. I got a little money parked there.
Oh, do you? Well, I hope they're taking good care of you. I started off as a stockbroker years ago, and then I did some personal finance books, and then I segued into biographies about rich and famous people. Mm-hmm. And today I work as a financial writer or vice president in communications at T. Rowe Price, doing a lot of their investment writing and communications, and so that keeps me busy and out of trouble.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to tell you that I went to school at Northwestern, which is in Evanston, Illinois, and at the time it was a dry town. And the reason was that the Women's Christian Temperance Union had been founded in Evanston, and into the 70s when I was in college, they retained Prohibition there. It was an interesting little pocket because it was just a mile and a half to the Chicago border where there was a line of liquor stores to service the needs of students at Northwestern. And my gateway drug, what got me started in what has become a lifelong appreciation for wines, including American-made wines, was Boone's Farm apple wine. It was the Strawberry Hill that I was fond of. And I can remember it was so strange because I was underage and I had a fake Wisconsin State ID. And you could call this liquor store on the northern border of Chicago, and they would come and deliver a case. They only took case orders. You couldn't just buy a bottle. And what was fascinating was that I would write the guy a check, and he'd say, I need some ID. Okay, so I provided my driver's license, which showed my real age. And then he said, oh, I need some ID for the purchase. Then I'd pull out my fake Wisconsin state ID. And he just took it, took my check, left the wine. And that's how I got started in wine. And I've upgraded since. I don't think I've tasted a Boone's Farm product. Do they even still make it, do you know?
I don't think so. I haven't seen it on the shelves anymore. I think that you can still find gallon jugs of a gallon Mountain Burgundy in a few different locations. But I think all those old wine cooler type products like Bartles and James and Moon's Farms, I think that's gone by the wayside by now. And good riddance to them, I'd say.
Well, I would too. But what's interesting is that the Gallo brothers, Ernest and Julio, really made wine in huge amounts. They were bulk winemakers, and that's how they had started with their parents, making just kind of red table wines. And then during Prohibition, they had to play a lot of games, and they were selling grapes, and they were selling sacramental wine. That's how people got around the law at that time. But really, for the bulk of the time that they were producing wine, they made pretty, you know, average stuff, the Planck. They were selling volume at low price, and that's the scheme that they used to really build their dominance of the marketplace. And it was only really in the last 20 or 30 years that they started to go for gold medals and try to use finer wines and varietal wines to sell their bulk wines. And so it's a very interesting process where there are many others. Let's compare them with the Mondavis. The Mondavi brand started out as a varietal premium wine, and then they bought the Woodbridge Winery in the Central Valley and started to make cheaper wines, more affordable wines, and bulk wines in you know, liter and a half containers. So they kind of used a different track where the Gallos now can be very proud of the wines they make in Sonoma County. They really didn't start out that way, did they?
Well, no. I mean, Prohibition killed the American palate for wine in this country for quite a long time. There was a time back in the 1800s, and even, well, going back to the days of Thomas Jefferson, when people did consume good wines. And then, so it was on tables. People drank it with their meals. But Prohibition came along, and it was easy to make beer and bathtub gin at home. And so this country became a beer and a whiskey drinking country. So here the Gallos come along in 1933 when Prohibition ends. And you mentioned Mondavi and Sebastiani, and all the competitors out there had a leg up on them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, Ernest was a guy who was easy to hate. He was a tough guy. He was really a bit of a thug the way he treated people. But he was also a bit of a genius as well. I mean, you don't go on to create a wine empire unless you have a sense of the marketplace and the way things are going. So Julia was the one who wanted to, he was the winemaker. He wanted to make good wines, and Ernest said, no. He said, there's no market for it. So they started out with products like Thunderbird, which was nothing more than just sweet, cheap sweet port, enhanced with brandy and then cut with lemon juice to cut the sweetness out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge blockbuster bestseller for them. I mean, Ernest had that story about how he knew he had a winner on his hands when he went through a ghetto, I think it was in L.A., and he yelled out the window of his car to some drunk on the sidewalk. He said, "What's the word?" And the guy yells back, "Thunderbird." He said he knew he had a leg up on that market. And he made an awful lot of money on that. And then, of course, after that, it was Boone's Farm and the Bartles and James that we mentioned and so on. So it was a long, long time before people wanted to start drinking good table wines with their meals in this country.
Yeah, there's an old bar song, WPLJ, White Port and Lemon Juice.
White Port and Lemon Juice, right. And it was actually discovered by accident when one of the Gallo salesmen saw them pouring the top. They would actually drink about 3 or 4 ounces out of a bottle of sweet port, and then they would squeeze lemon juice into it. And so they asked the liquor salesman, why are they doing that? He said, it's too sweet for them.
Mm-hmm.
They're cutting it with lemon juice.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, you know, Julia went to the laboratory and came up with a formula that really worked for them.
Yeah. And they also developed fortified wines that, you know, got you high quicker and cheaper. And those were very high-margin, profitable products that really helped, you know, the profit margins and the expansion of the Gallo Empire.
Yeah, they the way they finally outcompeted everybody is they learned how to make this stuff on the cheap, and then and they priced it. They could price it just right so that their profit margins were a little larger than everybody else's. And so Ernest was a very shrewd businessman, and he and Giulio had their own war going on. Giulio was a little bit premature and wanting to go upscale, and mm-hmm. Ernest held him back, and it paid off well. I mean, the Gallo Winery is actually the largest in the world today, and people don't even realize how big they are because it's a privately held firm.
Now, Jerry, one of the things that makes this interesting for you as a writer is that the official history, particularly that that's been promoted by the late Ernest Gallo, is at variance with the facts. And they kind of buried the issues of how their parents died. And, of course, later on there was this big legal struggle with their little brother, Joe. Let's talk about the history of the parents and the murky situation when they kind of packed up and left Modesto and started a new winery operation in Fresno, which is where they died.
Yeah, the book actually starts off with a murder, and it's the murder of Ernest and Giulio's mother and father, Joseph and Susie Gallo. They were found shot to death on their ranch in Fresno, and where they kind of wanted to hide out. And the police covered it up. It went down as a murder-suicide, and Ernest portrayed it that way, where his father went crazy and shot the wife and then took his own life. But I interviewed the son of the man who found the bodies. He's still alive. He's in his late 80s. And it wasn't just the bodies of the parents who were found. They also found the bodies of their two dogs who were shot to death. And there was a check for the to pay property taxes in the mailbox. And, I mean, you don't shoot your dogs if you're going to shoot your wife and then yourself, but a hitman might do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're certainly not going to pay your taxes. And other circumstantial evidence, I mean, Joseph's fingerprints were found on the barrel of the gun, not the handle.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this was all covered up at the time by the police. So then you have to look for motivation here. And different members of the Gallo family have told me that simply they owed money to the wrong people. I mean, there was an uncle in the picture here, an Uncle Mike, who was Ernest and Giulio's uncle, the father's brother,
mm-hmm.
who was known as a kind of a West Coast Al Capone. And he was involved in all kinds of mob activities, shakedown artist of sort. He spent time in San Quentin.
Mm-hmm.
And after the crash of 29, the price of grapes came down along with the stock market. And Joseph had to borrow some money. And so members of the family have said, well, they certainly owed money to the wrong people, and they were a little afraid of that. And there was also some rumors circulating at the time that Ernest, who hated his father, I mean, for good reason, I mean, the man was brutal.
He passed that along to his own kids, too. That was part of that era. I know a lot of people, you know, who had brutal fathers and who modeled that and passed it along to the next generation.
It's hard to break the pattern, I guess. We always try to avoid, well, not, we all don't try to, but a lot of us try to break the pattern of our fathers and say, well, I don't want to commit those mistakes with my own kids. But mm-hmm. In Ernest's case, I mean, the father beat them up. He used to beat his wife up. He verbally brutalized his entire family. And Ernest was very much a chip off the old block, more so than Giulio. He was the tougher, more ruthless brother. And he turned out to do the same thing to his own kids. I interviewed some former Gallo executives who said they never saw a man brutalize his own son verbally the way Ernest did.
Yeah.
His oldest son, David, was found dead in a bathtub just about 10 years ago. And, I mean, it's always been very hush-hush about what happened. My own feeling is that it may well have been a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And he drove his son that far. I also interviewed some advertising people who worked on the Gallo account and went out there. And Ernest would be insulting his son in front of everybody. And David was totally out of his mind, really. He'd be crawling around under the table, barking like a dog. He would stick paper clips under his eyelids for no apparent reason.
Mm-hmm.
And Ernest refused to acknowledge that there was something wrong with that boy and that he was somehow going to step into his Ernest footsteps when Ernest finally passed the baton. And there was just no way that was going to happen.
Yeah. Now, after the parents died under these murky circumstances, there was a will, and it had two key provisions. One is that it passed control of the winery to all three sons, but Joseph, the youngest, was under 21, and so Ernest and Julio were made his guardians. And they played games with him and were not honest with him about his inheritance, and this came back to bite them in the court cases in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, there were, it got very contentious between the two older brothers on one side, Ernest and Julio, and young Joe, who was 10 years younger than Ernest, 9 years younger than Julio. He basically screwed them, sued them for disinheriting him. He said that they cheated him out of one-third of the parents' estate, and that he should have been an equal partner in the winery, and he didn't really understand that until they found some documents in the courthouse. But it started with Ernest and Julio suing the younger brother, and Ernest had no love lost for the younger brother, who was the only one who escaped the beatings from the father. And they sued him because he put his name on a line of cheese he was putting out,
yeah.
Joseph Gallo cheese. And, I mean, it wouldn't seem you can win a case like that. He said, well, it's my name, too. I have as much right to it. They claimed that Gallo was a proprietary name associated with the winery, and they actually beat him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he turned around, and he had a countersuit against them for his one-third of the interest in the winery, and they beat him on that one, too. There were rumors that Ernest had bought the judges involved and a few other key players. He certainly had deeper pockets to afford legal talent. And it led to the youngest brother's slow demise over the next 10 years or so. Well, actually, the next 20 years. He suffered a series of strokes, and he died in 2007, totally debilitated, actually within weeks of his oldest brother Ernest's death.
And Ernest was quite a litigious guy. In fact, you describe in some detail the political influence that he cultivated with Senator Alan Cranston and others here in California. And one thing I didn't see in the book that I'm aware of is that they used that influence to get a federal court cited in Modesto. And so it's, you know, kind of in casual terms referred to as the Gallo Court. And they did have a friendly judge there often over the years. I don't know the current status. Ernest would file lots of lawsuits against competitors. He was very zealous in protecting the Rooster and the Gallo name. And so that kind of muscle was something that they were used to using when Joe, from their point of view, tried to get out of line.
Yeah, they have sued all kinds of people, not just the potential competitors, but anybody who's dared to use the Gallo name on a line of products that had nothing whatsoever to do with wine. There was a young woman in Texas who had a line of ceramics she was putting out and called them Gallo because they were in the shape of roosters. And they actually, well, she couldn't afford to withstand a lawsuit from them, so she caved in and they beat her. They've sued anybody over the years who's used the name in any form whatsoever. And you mentioned Modesto. I mean, I was out there, and my interpretation is that it's pretty much a company town. The Gallows, you know, they have the big art center there.
You're darn right. there's no doubt about it.
They bring a lot of money in and a lot of talent, and they have a lot of clout there. They probably employ half the town, and Ernest has used the power of the courts very like a weapon over people.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned politics. He's played both sides of the political fence.
Indeed.
They started with Bill Clinton back in the early 90s after Clinton first came into office, and they got some favorable tax legislation passed. Bob Dole, a Republican, started to complain. He called it the Gallo Tax Amendment, so they turned around and became his number one campaign contributor. So Bob Dole suddenly shut his mouth and kept a low profile, and They used money to try to keep imported wine from Chile, Argentina, Australia out of the country.
Well, and they were the drivers behind the Wine Institute based in San Francisco. And they used that when they didn't want their fingerprints on an effort, for example, to stifle imports.
Yeah, it was like a proxy for them, just another hammer to use in their arsenal of weapons.
Yeah.
So they were very very effective in doing that. And I mean, Ernest lived to the ripe old age of 98. He died in 2007, and I guess only the really good die young, you might say, is a lesson to be learned from that. I don't know.
Well, I saw that segment on 60 Minutes about the value of daily consumption of red wine. So in Ernest's case, it worked. We're talking with Jerome Tuccilli. His new book, Gallo Be Thy Name, subtitled The Inside Story of How One Family Rose to Dominate the U.S. Wine Market. The Peter B. Collins Show is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company, much to the chagrin of the Gallows, since 1980. Click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com. There's a special introductory offer from the Organic Wine Company just for you. Jerry Tuccilli, I've got a couple of stories for you about my limited contact with the Gallows. In the early 90s, I was doing a daily talk show on a 50,000-watt station in San Francisco, KNBR, and the station also carried the Giants. And I learned that Julio Gallo was a big sports fan, and I also was warned by an employee that he was a regular listener to my program. And what prompted the warning was that I referred to Modesto as the place where Julio meets Julio. And Julio was a composite for farm workers. And the Gallows had their trouble with Cesar Chavez, the Great Boycott, and the unionization of farm workers that occurred in the 70s and 80s here in California. And basically, I got this back channel message saying, "Watch it. Julio doesn't like it when you say that." So tell us a little bit about their issues with labor, and in particular, the company town of Modesto was a place that they were used to controlling. And they didn't like the idea of Chavez organizing the people who picked their grapes.
Well, Ernest met his match in Chavez. Chavez, as you say, tried to organize the grape pickers into his union. Ernest actually at first admired him. He saw a kind of a plucky guy who pulled himself up, as he did to a great extent. But Chavez was shrewd. He knew that he needed to make pick one name, one winery, and Gallo was going to be his target. And he led that march onto Modesto, which was the headquarters of the Gallo Empire at the time, and gave a speech right there in a park in the middle of town, whipping up the troops and so on. Ernest made a big mistake in trying to be his own PR spokesman. He was just not a sympathetic guy. Chavez knew how to play the media. He had a good cause on his hands. There were a lot of abuses at the time with grape pickers working under inhuman conditions and so on. And Ernest essentially admitted later on that Chavez taught him a lot about publicity, because sometimes it's not always the truth, it's the perception of the truth and how you portray it. And Chavez was a master at it. And eventually, you know, they came to some sort of agreement, and then the media turned its attention elsewhere, and then the issue died. But Chavez definitely got the best of that encounter, and Ernest learned a few lessons from it.
And you point out in your book that it caused them to try to burnish their image, and they dropped $400,000 for a research center at Modesto Hospital and stepped up their contributions to other entities, Stanford, Notre Dame, and other places. So it had an interesting impact on them.
Well, they became good citizens, or at least better citizens after that. They ran into problems, too, when they went over to Sonoma in the beginning. I mean, their headquarters was Modesto in the Central
mm-hmm.
Valley.
Mm-hmm.
But then they were buying up land in Sonoma, and they got in early when land was still fairly cheap over there, and they brought in these huge earth contouring machines and just started leveling the hills. And, of course, the environmentalists and anybody who cared about the land and keeping it natural and so on, we're up in arms against the gallows, and that got them more bad publicity for a while. But the newer generations have learned to overcome that. They've, from people I've spoken to, they say the gallows, with the grandchildren in place now, Gina and Matt, grandchildren of Julio,
mm-hmm.
have actually become pretty good stewards of the land over there. So.
Yeah, in fact, I recently talked to the district attorney in Sonoma County, and he told me that they were rather cooperative, and they settled a series of environmental suits out of court without a lot of flack. I think they paid about $500,000 into a county fund for remediation of other topography, because that's, as you point out, they were moving earth, building lakes and irrigation systems, and they really made major changes in the topography in this huge facility that they have developed in Sonoma County.
Yeah, it was a shrewd move to go in that direction. I mean, you just they knew it was a losing battle. $500,000 is pocket lint for the Gallo family, and
mm-hmm.
It's just the cost of doing business. And I do think that the youngest generation there in place now, in their 40s, are probably about 15 or 18 different Gallo family members, and pretty good positions within the company, have a whole different attitude toward the business than the founders did. You know, thank God for that.
And, Jerry, you know, the reputation well-earned is that the Gallo brothers, Ernest and Julio, were very hard-nosed, tough businessmen, and they would take advantage of the shifts in markets, et cetera. But I have an interesting story that counters that. I have a friend named Bruce Cohn, who has become quite a fine winemaker, the B.R. Cohn Winery in Sonoma. He made his money managing the Doobie Brothers and other rock bands, and he put it into a winery operation. And before he opened the winery, he was growing grapes there, and he had a bad year. And he couldn't sell his grapes at a price that would recover his costs, and basically he was at risk of losing his investment. And he called Julio Gallo, and he said Julio came up on a Saturday by helicopter, landed in one of his vineyards, had lunch with him, and agreed to buy his grapes at something like 20% over the market price for that year. And Bruce said that without that, he would not be a winemaker with gold medals as he is today. And I found that striking because so many of the stories are about the training programs that Ernest had for salespeople, how they were told to go into a store and just basically take over. And it didn't matter if the retailer objected. You move that Gallo product to the aisle end. You make it prominent. They even had techniques like their salespeople carried bottles of dust, and they would spray dust on the product of their competitors to make it look like that stuff wasn't moving, but the shiny, clean Gallo bottles were, you know, turning over every 10 minutes.
Yeah, they were constantly moving bottles of wine up to eye level where they could be, it's like an author going into a bookstore, taking his book off the back shelves and moving them up where people can see them.
And you've never done that, but I know people who have.
It, no.
You've never been caught.
No. But another trick they used was back screwing the the screw tops on them, you know, just so that people couldn't open them. But it's interesting you mentioned about overpaying for the grapes. So they've done the same thing in the Central Valley more recently, within the last couple of years, because a lot of the grape growers in the Central Valley were selling out to real estate developers during the real estate boom. And so the source of grapes was drying up, as you know, as the grape growing farms were disappearing and replaced by tract housing. The Gallows actually went out there and guaranteed them a price 15-20% over market just to keep them in business. And it turned out to be a very shrewd business move for them because it was an incentive for them to continue growing grapes instead of selling out to developers, mm-hmm. and keeping a source of the grapes to the Gallows. You know, they do grow some of their own grapes, but not enough to supply the demand for their products.
Right, yeah. I have one other story for you, and that is in the mid-90s. Well, first I'll mention that in addition to producing and hosting radio shows, I do commercials and all kinds of projects that involve audio and video. And I got a call from one of my friends who worked for an advertising rep firm. And they said, can you help us out? We've got this situation where the Gallo Company has signed a contract for $1 million ad campaign to support one of their crappy phony champagnes. I think it was Tots. And we have been unable to get them to approve the creative because Ernest Gallo keeps rejecting the work. And a very prominent San Francisco agency had the Gallo account. And they told the people at the rep firm, look, we've given up. We have submitted 10 different commercials and spent a lot of money on it, and Ernest has rejected every one. So if you want to hire an outside producer and try to salvage this deal for the fourth quarter of this year, you have our blessing. So I ride down to Modesto with this woman from the rep firm. And she's warning me, you're going into an alligator pit here. And it was fascinating because I had no illusions, but I was willing to take the business if they were willing to give it to me. So we drive up, and the first thing I notice is that there's no signage. It doesn't say Gallo World Headquarters. And there's no sign downtown that says, you know, Gallo is on this road a half mile down or anything like that. And as we drove up, it has the look of a community college campus. There are trees and parking lots, and there's this one large building that is the headquarters. So we go in there, and what I noticed is the far wall of this building, and it's a huge two-story kind of atrium style where on the second floor there are just offices around the perimeter, but the center is open. And at the far end is this huge mahogany wall. Maybe it's oak, but it's a fine polished wood finish, a dark sheen to it. And at the center are these huge doors. And that was Ernest's office complex. And he did not emerge during the 2 hours that I was there. But about eight times during this meeting with his advertising people, they would simply point to those doors and kind of shudder. And the message was clear that what I was suggesting, well, let's do this or why don't we try that, they either would tell me that somebody had already suggested that or they'd point at the door, they'd say, he won't approve it. And so the feeling of fear was really palpable in that building. And people were there happy to have a job, happy to be part of a successful company. But they were always looking over their shoulder in the direction of Ernest's office.
Well, Ernest was a dictator. I mean, 2,000 years ago, he would have been a Julius Caesar, or a Roman emperor, maybe. I mean, he ruled by fear. And it's very interesting that you mentioned about the look of the place there. It has this incredible institutional look. I mean, just about every other winery I ever been to is welcoming. It's beautiful landscaping, and that they welcome the public in. This looks like almost like a prison camp.
Yeah.
And if you go down outside of Healdsburg on Dry Creek Road, you can't even get into the winery there. There's a gate with a gatekeeper at it, and if you don't have business at the winery, you can't get in there.
Well, I was allowed in once to tape Gina Gallo for a radio show. And they were pretty hospitable. But you're right, the perimeter is secure, and it's not. They now have a tasting room, I think, in Healdsburg, the town. But you can't go to the winery and tour it the way you can almost every other facility in the state.
No, right on the square in Healdsburg, they do have that tasting room, and that's basically the only place where the public has access to the wine. And they have a good lineup of wines now. You mentioned before they've won awards. They in blind tastings.
Oh, I'll tell you point blank that their Sonoma wines are really good, and they're a good value. They often sell. You can get them at Cost Plus or other places for under $10. And their Cabernet, their Zinfandel, their Pinot Noir. I'm not a big Merlot fan, but they make a good Merlot too. They're all high quality, and there's a Chardonnay for under $10 that I think is also pretty reliable.
Yeah, I was talking to a few the vintners out there who said that some of the wines that they're making, other vintners will have to charge $25, $30 a bottle for, if not more. The Gallows can do it at a lower cost point because, as I mentioned before, they bought land in Sonoma when it was much cheaper than it is today.
Yeah.
So they have got themselves a nice competitive niche in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. So Julio met a terrible end a few years before he died in an auto accident. His wife had an auto accident on the, I think, the Pacheco Pass. And that was tragic because Ernest did live a full life, as you pointed out. But Julio was plagued with health problems after that first accident and never really seemed to get his mojo back.
No, I believe it was around 1993. He was driving. He insisted on driving himself. So when the car rolled over, and again, it was a tragic accident and something that the family didn't even like to talk too much about. They've always been very secretive and quiet. There was very little public information disseminated by the Gallo people at that time. But he predeceased Ernest by 14 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things that you pointed out in the book, and I follow the California wine industry, fairly closely, and you point out that they have really bought up a lot of other brands in the last few years. And the volume now is, do you have a sense of what they're up to?
Well, there's still some resistance to buying a better wine with the Gallo name on it because a lot of people, particularly if you're closer to my age, they associate it with the Thunderbirds and the Gallo Mountain Burgundy. So what they did was they went out and bought labels like Fry Brothers and Louis Martini and Miroso.
Mm-hmm.
There's a laundry list, and also South African wines like Sabeca and Bella Sera from Italy. So you're drinking Gallo wines without even knowing it if you're drinking any of these other labels, and you won't see Gallo's name on it, but you will see Modesto, California, which is pretty much of a giveaway.
Yes, it is. There is no other winery in Modesto.
No, and there never will be, I don't think, as long as the Gallos are around.
Jerry, what would you like to close with? Maybe one more story from the book.
Well, I think the takeaway is the funny thing is that the old joke is that it takes about three generations to blow the founder's money and his empire. And we're working on the fourth generation here, and it's not happening yet. People I speak to say the Gallos are pretty much in a good position right now. They've got smart management in place with the younger generation and doing the right things environmentally and so on. So here's a family that has not yet self-destructed, and it'll be interesting to watch the kind of progress they make over the next few years. I mean, like in any business, there's always new competitors coming in and that sort of thing, but I think it's going to be hard to knock the Gallows out of the catbird seat anytime soon.
Jerry, a real pleasure talking with you. Next time you're in California, can I buy you a glass of wine?
Absolutely, and whatever label you like. Thank you.
Well, I'll get you something from the Organic Wine Company. They're my favorite.
Okay.
The book is Gallo Be Thy Name, the inside story of how one family rose to dominate the U.S. wine market. We've been talking with Jerome Tuccilli. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, and first-time novelist Lauren Farber joins us now. Lauren's an old friend, and we have something important in common.
Yeah, we're both Buckeyes. Thanks for having me on your show.
Great to have you here, Lauren. Now, this is a song about Kent State. It's the closest I could get to Akron. Is there any Akron music or theme music that you would know of?
There may be some stuff coming up, I hear, with LeBron James is sort of doing some entertaining in Akron, and Shaquille O'Neal is supposed to be getting some stuff there. Akron's had quite a renaissance, but I'm a graduate of Kent State, so this song certainly has memories, and it's the 100th anniversary of Kent State, and they're having a memorial to this event as a key part of the centennial of the university. So that's very interesting.
And will there be somebody to denounce James A. Rhodes, the governor, the Republican governor who ordered the National Guard to shoot?
You know, we're in another universe. There is no knowledge of the history. The people that are going there now are very directed into their careers, and very few of them know what those events are about, which is the principal reason why they're building the monument.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad they're doing that.
As a matter of fact, when I was visiting there, I was just doing a book signing. There was a whole building complex, and it was named after one of the people that was shot at Kent State. And I knew that because he was a friend of someone who went to school with me just up the road in Cleveland. And I'm saying, whoa, that name sounds familiar. And here's this whole five-building complex named after him.
Mm-hmm.
Very moving.
Huh, that's cool. Now let me exhaust my Ohio music.
Oh, how cruel you are. Cincinnati. I can't believe it. There is no Akron music. I could sing Round on the Outsides, High in the Middle, Ohio. But
well, that song that the Pretenders did is loosely about Akron and Cleveland, isn't it?
Yeah, Chrissy Hines
My
has
city
a restaurant.
Was gone.
Chrissy Hines has opened up a vegetarian restaurant in Akron, Ohio. It's doing very well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Huh, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, it's down the block from the new art museum, which is also a landmark attraction. So Akron's kept itself fresh.
Now, Lauren Farber, your new novel, your first, is called Portage, and I've been reading it. I'm engrossed. And I went to Google Maps here. It's displayed on this computer, and I could not find the Portage Path.
How unfortunate, because it's a main thoroughfare in Akron, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm from Akron. I'm a native from there. And one end of Portage Path is Metropolitan Parks. And the cover of the book has the path marker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bas-relief that was done in the 20s. And I very vividly remember that because it was part of a field trip. And you felt like you were walking in a primeval forest on a path.
Mm-hmm.
But it's next to a road. And I also remember heavy trucks cutting through there to get from one highway to another to cut some time out, which they can't do anymore.
Can you point it out for me on the screen here where it would be or should be? I mean, this is downtown Akron.
You have to pull it out a little bit farther. It's on that side of Market. So you're in too close in downtown Akron. It's out on the outskirts on the west side.
Will you notify Google?
I will.
Because I put in Portage Path, and they sent me to downtown Akron.
I have been sent to very many strange places by these map things.
Now, I was first drawn to your book because what you do is you connect the history of the area and the Native American tribes who portaged their canoes from river to river across a critical piece of land. And throughout the book, you give us tidbits of history about how this became a part of treaties. It was a border line that was devised, and the white men who came to acquire basically saw this as a very valuable strip of land. Tell us why.
Well, it was the first treaty line negotiated by the new United States, and it was with the Iroquois Nation, and it represents the first expansion west from the original 13 colonies. Perhaps the original is into Kentucky, but people are starting to move west in the late 1700s. And they stumble over this paradise here, which is a people of the Iroquois are the Erie Nation, hence the Lake Erie.
Right.
And so we're on the shores there. And now, not to get too cerebral, we switch into chaos theory. You've seen the butterfly on TV where if it flaps its wings and the raindrop goes one side, it goes north, and another side, it goes south. Similarly, this is the watershed. So water that goes on the north side of this trail goes to rivers that run into Lake Erie and out the St. Lawrence into the Atlantic.
That would be the Cuyahoga going north from Akron.
Exactly, mm-hmm. and that's what this portage is. Mm-hmm. And the Tuscaroras, where it portages to, is the river system that runs to the Ohio River, mm-hmm. past Cincinnati and down Mississippi into the Gulf.
Well, we could taste it because we drank river water.
Good. You had it all from upstream. So I found that fascinating that it was just sort of random, and that tied together with the idea that why is it this 8-mile strip of land is getting so much violence to it? The book is about not just the stories that are there, but about a shootout that takes place in 1972 between a petty drug lord and the Akron police, and it happens in Portage Path Park, mm-hmm. and that's at the south end of Portage Path. And mm-hmm. Portage Path runs parallel, or runs all the way through Akron to the east side. Mm-hmm. And all along there, there are famous landmarks. The area does a great job of identifying Indian chiefs. And so there's some beautiful bronze statues all along the path. And there's also a house that John Brown owned. And John Brown...
At 4800 Portage Path.
Yes, I gave a number to it. Mm-hmm. And John Brown lived there from the 1840s to the 1850s before he became an activist at Harper's Ferry.
Mm-hmm. So what drew you to the history? Was this part of your childhood? Did you cavort on the Portage Path and imagine what it was like?
Of course, everybody did. It's a great town to grow up in. It's a very small town, but it has a downtown, so you feel like you're mm-hmm. in a suburban setting, and it has its own identity. And it's a fun town, as I said, so there are a lot of outdoor things to do, especially along the Portage Path, toboggan mm-hmm. runs and skating, and I did all those things. There's also a rich Indian history, which they teach in the schools. But I was drawn to it by the idea of just random accident. Why do all these accidents happen here? And so I created a history professor at Akron University, and he was publishing something called Violence on the Portage Path. And I also struck on the idea that communities are held together by what they read and what they think. And this becomes a popular magazine that everybody on Portage Path is reading. So we move along to a variety of addresses of people that are neighbors of the main character mm-hmm. or four blocks down. The drug deals happening on the other side of town on Portage Path. The schools on Portage Path, Akron University. Shootout with the police takes place at Portage Path. Mm-hmm. The heroine of this has an estate that's on the Portage Path. So all these stories tie together. So you have one line, which is the resolution of this drug shootout, and this takes you to the seamy side of Cleveland. And it gets into race relations and attitudes at that time mm-hmm. in the 70s. And that story is interwoven with some artful stories that I just made up, and the age of exploration, and the French and Indian War, and colorful people like Mad Anthony Wayne, who was a general at that mm-hmm. time.
LaSalle.
LaSalle, an explorer there. Mm-hmm. And so it gave me license to just express things like about class and race and amplify what was happening at that mm-hmm. time, which was a very interesting time in American history.
Yeah. Now, the Native American part of it I found fascinating. And from southern Ohio, we didn't have portage-type Indians. We had mound builders.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Serpent Mound and all that stuff.
And that was a part of my heritage where, you know, you could go to parks and just open space or people's backyards, and there was a mound there, and in it were these artifacts from the generations of natives who had lived there. And so it helped shape, I think, my early understanding of Native Americans. Have you been to the new Smithsonian Indian Museum in Washington?
No, I haven't. But to remark about that, Michael Chabon, who wrote Cavalier and Clay, won the Pulitzer Prize for that, published an article about how people are losing their childhood because we watch them so much because of so many horrible things that are happening. And he grew up in Maryland, and he was talking about the same thing that you're talking about, how he was free to roam and go where the Indians were and go where the 17th century explorers with the frills coming out of their leather jackets, you know, the lace, that sort of stuff, and the high boots were stepping off and declaring the land for King James, that sort of thing. But he was saying that we're losing our childhoods because of that. And you have a vivid memory of that. And in the book, I'm calling upon a place, but I didn't name it after the site. But it's Wolf Ledges, and this is along the east side of town. It's no longer on the Portage Path. It's a little bit away from it. But it is exactly where the pre-Columbian Indians lived, aboriginal almost. You know, so the early, before they formed into tribes, the early residents of that area. And you can see cave paintings and things like that. Yeah. And that's in the book.
Well, I understand your point, and I don't want to sound really ancient like a dinosaur, but when I was growing up in Cincinnati, people were not real touchy about crossing their property. And so you could go into the woods. We had a woods with a creek behind our house, and we could explore there and come up on the other side on Tecumseh Trail, it was called. And the people weren't, you know, they didn't mind that you came into their backyard or that you were looking at, you know, their trees or that kind of thing. They didn't have...
Boy, that brings back a memory.
Attack there was dogs or alarm systems.
There was a house on Palisades Avenue, and I could cut back through there, through my backyard and through an open field that was baseball during season and football during season. This is winter, and everybody was on saucer sleds on their backyard, and what a mess we made of their yard. And the people just enjoyed it, looking out their windows, and nobody minded anybody cutting through anybody's yard. And I haven't thought about that since you just raised that, you know, and we're in a different world now.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned the new Smithsonian Museum. It's about 5 years old in Washington, and I think it's really worth a visit. I did feel, and I'm not an expert on Native American tribes, that they focused on not the full range. And so, sure, the Iroquois and the Mohicans were there, but there were a lot of tribes that I've been familiar with, including some since I moved to California, that are not represented there, and I'm not really sure why.
I agree. I think the West is not properly represented. I understand that there are museums in, like, the Dakotas that sort of are more balanced, but there's a... museum in Youngstown, Ohio, that has the paintings of Curtis and photographs of the Indians and some pretty famous collections there. And it's pretty concentrated in the area, pretty much the eastern United States.
Now, in your novel, we got sex, we got drugs, we've got characters.
We got rock and roll.
I didn't get to the rock and roll part. Who plays?
Linda Ronstadt.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, while this trucker is going through his glove compartment looking for a roach clip.
I saw the roach clip part.
You missed Linda Ronstadt.
I missed Linda there.
Gosh. The detail I put into this, and look what happens.
Look, yeah. Well, the other part that I connected with was just the weather. It's fall to winter. And you described that very well for someone who exiled to California 30-plus years ago.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's hard to remember yesterday sometimes at this point.
Yeah. So did you go on fact-finding missions to Akron to refresh your memory, to capture some of the details?
Well, truth be known, I wrote this when I was in Akron, so I didn't have to go back there to do it. And the other part of it is that the people who are in the drug deal were from a neighboring high school. And so I knew them through – Akron's a fairly small town.
So well, you named the drug dealer Piqua, which is the name of a town in Ohio.
Yeah, Piqua. He was one of them. And that's the person that I wanted to show the difference in race relations. And then there's this heiress and Susanna Frizzell, and I wanted to show class difference. And, and there's very strong it's – it's a microcosm of the United States. Akron is very representative.
And there's nothing about rubber trees.
That's true. We kept the rubber we kept the rubber city out of this, so that's true.
When you grew up there, could you smell the rubber plants?
Absolutely. You tried to hold your breath all the way past Goodrich. Couldn't happen.
And those are gone now, right?
No, Goodyear is still functioning there.
Oh, yeah?
It's a sight to see. You know, you can see all of the mills active and the lights on in the evening. It does smell of rubber, and there's this huge Goodyear sign that is part of Akron Heritage, and there's a cemetery right near there where, ironically, Goodrich is buried. And the Goodrich side of town is being developed into something else. The canal used to go through there, the Erie Canal. And so they're developing a mixed-use area, and they've built a AA ballpark there where the Akron Arrows play, and it looks like Camden Yards. And they've opened up a number of bars and restaurants along the canal, which they had built over. They had pretty much done like a land bridge over it to just cover it. And now they're uncovering it and making it a very lovely walk area. Yeah. And they're tearing down parts of the factory and changing that into other types of areas. So they've got a very good city planning team going there.
And I have never been to Akron, I have to confess. I've been to Cleveland and Youngstown and Canton, but never really spent any time in Akron.
Well, you missed a great deal.
And tell me how you find it today. Is it 'cause Ohio is not as bad off as Michigan, but Ohio's had a real tough time the last 3 years. They were on the early edge of this recession.
Well, I was surprised at the internecine warfare that was happening there. Akron's very resourceful, and they created something called the Inventors Hall of Fame. And I wasn't aware, not living there anymore, the tax breaks that were given by the local community to get this thing built in Akron as opposed to the next county, like Canton. Okay? Canton hasn't done a good job of keeping things together, but they've got...
They got the Football Hall of Fame, man.
That's it. They got the Football Hall of Fame, and they've got the McKinley Memorial. And those are two huge attractions. We underestimate how McKinley was loved in this country, by the way. Anyway, those are two huge attractions, but there's nothing around there, you know. And, well, because of his assassination, we got Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
But that wasn't his chief accomplishment. But that, maybe that's another book down the road. So anyway, I was surprised when I was there last on a book signing tour that there was a big controversy. The board of the museum decided to pull out and move to the next city because of other advantages that were being offered. And it's not only was mean-spirited, but they had a brand new museum that was just built. So to do that, you know, last I heard, you can't pick up a three-story building and move it to the next county. You got to build a new one, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was surprised that was happening because that's counterproductive. But overall, I found Akron to be a lot of fun. I was telling a friend of mine also from Akron, there was this new bar open called Percoco's. And I immediately thought of, quote-unquote, Whiskey Dick Percoco. And he is a bail bondsman, and he got a lot of people out of jail during Prohibition.
Ah.
And he grew very big and owned a lot of real estate. And people of my generation, their fathers and grandfathers sort of knew Dick on a first basis. You know, it was that type of town. You just sort of... all of a sudden, you're at the same sandwich place, or you show up now, at downtown.
Is there a story here? Your grandparents knew a bail bondsman.
No, well, he was a bootlegger before that, so that's even worse. You know, that's where he got the name Whiskey Dick. He was
thirsty
a bootlegger.
Thirsty grandparents.
Yeah, that sort of thing. I don't know the whole story, but the minute I told the name of the restaurant to this friend of mine who now lives out here, he immediately told me the entire history of Whiskey Dick Percoco and how many people he knew him. And I said, you know, you're preaching to the choir. Well, a whole new bar and a whole new generation is now at this real trendy bar that's over the canal, and they've persuaded other bars to go near there, and they're within walking distance and reasonable walking distance to the ballpark. That's good planning.
Yeah.
And the streets, it looks like these little toddler toys that for three-year-olds, you know, where it's a clean white ramp that goes off the freeway and into a garage, that sort of thing. That's exactly what these things look like. You have these freeways that all connect downtown and very easily slip you into parking places and mercantile places and the courts and all that sort of stuff. So I was very favorably impressed.
Well, I'm going to have to make a trip there and check it out. Lauren Farber's new novel is Portage, and you can find it and order a copy at laurenfarber.com. LawrenFarber. Nothing in between. LaurenFarber.com. And Lauren, take a moment here because I'd like to explain to people that you worked in advertising and media, corporate communications, and for the last 10 or 15 years, you've been teaching English at community colleges in the South Bay. And I really like to help people become empowered. You publish this yourself. And we have a new concept called Be the Media. And we try to encourage people to use the form of expression that is comfortable for them. And you don't need a big contract from HarperCollins in terms of publishing. Here I'm podcasting, and I don't need Clear Channel anymore. And oh, I like that.
Empowerment. I like it.
So talk a little bit about the process of developing the manuscript and then why you decided to publish it this way and what the benefits have been.
Well, you mentioned that I teach, and I was doing some research for a lesson plan, and I came across something that said something to the effect of either 3,000 a day or 3,000 a week new books are published in the United States. And a lot of this happens through the new technology and on the Internet. And I'm presenting this to the class, and I'm saying, well, wait a minute, I've got probably the best insulated garage in the county with all these manuscripts backed up, and Hollywood is not looking for me, and I'm not getting any younger. Why don't I look into this? So I checked out a number of self-publishing places. And it was equal to the amount of work I put into finding an agent, finding a publisher 30 years ago. I mean, this isn't like an overnight sensation. In the 70s, I was peddling this physically in New York. And it's set up for rejection. But you, like any sales job, you have to go for it. In this case, I was just looking at competing brands, and I struck a deal because sales is my background, having been in business for myself, to publish two books for their offer. And they agreed to the deal, and this was the first one. I found the reason why I went with them was that they had the best price services and they had marketing depth. The new trend in publishing, the leader in publishing, is the publishing houses opening up their books, if you will, to people who want to self-publish. So there, this is not just Vanity Press. This is going into Bertelsmann and some of the other big houses. So anyway, I made my choice, and I found that they were easy to work with.
And this is Ex Libris?
This is Ex Libris. I found that they were easy to work with, but sometimes slow. And for I've been doing for a living communications for technology companies in Silicon Valley. So I know how and where to get the word out and what works, and I'm a reasonably good hack writer for these technology companies. So I would get these over-the-top press releases from Ex Libris, and I would tone them down and correct the English and move it around. And that was a very efficient process because I improved it immensely in one hit, and then the next draft was sort of like a technical draft, and then we're out of here. They also have great depth in terms of their database, but they won't turn the database over to you. So a lot of things they do are sort of old-fashioned.
Now, in that database, does that mean they've offered your book to customers of other authors?
No.
Or are you talking about retail?
Retail distribution? Retail database, like to publicize the book. Like they've got a they have a good fix on the print media in the United States, like all the newspapers in all the cities by their size. This is sort of like a Silicon Valley problem. The software allows them to do that, but nobody at the table is considering that the positions that are being encoded into this database no longer exist. The book review editors. There are no book review editors.
Yeah, they were laid off years ago.
Yeah, right. So a lot of this stuff goes out addressed to the book review editor, and there is no book review editor, or there is a part-time book review editor, and you're never going to find it. And so I was talking with one reviewer in Ohio who finally reviewed the book, and she basically described this windowless room where 300 books go a week that come in for the book review editor. She doesn't look at any of them unless it's addressed to her. It's got it's the old PR connection type of stuff.
Yeah. So then that's part of the critical. You can write a book. You can get it printed. They call that publishing.
Yeah.
But then you've got to get people aware of it, get them interested in it, and give them a location where they can get it.
Exactly. And I had to do all that work and all that thinking. I could be provided with information. Like, they provided me all the bookstores in Cleveland, Akron, and Youngstown. And so that's all the information. However, that had a few big ones missing.
Mm-hmm.
And I called all those places, and I set up 10 book signings in 10 days. And some of those I closed while I was there, like an interview with the local radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And I also took it upon myself to become an official Pulp Fiction writer and get into the store at the Akron Canton Airport.
Mm.
So I am there right by the cash register.
All right. You
know, Akron author makes good. And so I'm official Pulp Fiction. But I had to arrange all that stuff myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened so fast that I actually had to take a suitcase full of books. So I wound up buying my books twice, once paying the airlines and once paying the publisher, to get my books there so I would have something for them to sell, because it came together so quickly there was no time for them to order it from
mm-hmm.
the company.
Mm-hmm.
I made more money this way, a little bit more slowly. But more importantly, I created a base of my customers. And I started direct mail with them, and then I started an advertising campaign. And what I learned from all this is, like, you need a universe of people to buy the book. But that universe doesn't necessarily need to be in your backyard.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go to the market where this book has an appeal. Ironically, then I came back home and picked up my all the cold trails now for all the book signings in the area. And they finally came together, and now I have a book signing every weekend in October.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you mention? Do you happen to have that handy?
I have Barnes & Noble coming up this weekend at Almaden Expressway on October 3rd.
San Jose,
and,
okay.
And on the 10th, I'm going to be at Borders in Los Gatos. And the 17th, I'm going to be at Borders in Oak Ridge. Then I'm going to Akron, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
to be at Barnes & Noble in Fairlawn.
Watch out.
Yeah,
he's coming back.
It. That's it. Willy Bully. And, and then the end of the month, I'm going to be at the Prune Yard, Barnes & Noble.
That's in Campbell, California.
Right. And mm-hmm. The organization has been very nice. Barnes & Noble is triangulating their inventory, so it's nice to see creativity in the local market. These people are saying, instead of separately paying humongous shipping charges, why don't we just share the inventory and make mm-hmm. sure it goes across town? And I'm offering to make more signings, and we're experimenting with things. And one evening there was a book club there, and they're all going to read it next.
And so does Barnes & Noble buy your book or take it on consignment?
Yes. in Ohio, when I was there, I actually had to bring the books with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was like a consignment deal. But mm-hmm. for the most part, they buy through a common database.
I see.
And it's on that database, and it's returnable, therefore.
Mm-hmm.
So they will invest in that, and they like to work with local authors.
Mm-hmm.
It gets traffic, and all their friends show up, and so that works out pretty well.
They sell more coffee.
Among other things,
yeah.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Each time I go in there, I buy a book for my wife, so it's becoming a lost leader for me. But anyway, the sales are there, and the main story, though, is you have to make it happen. As I said, like, now I've got something going on in Northeast Ohio that I can operate from California.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a second volume coming out, and this is poetry,
yes.
due out at the end of October?
It's due out at the end of October. It's called Available in Stereo and Monaural. Selected Poems and Sonnets, 1969 to 2009. And as you and I were talking before the show, it shows a different side of me. It shows what I was like back in the 70s and what I am like now. And
well, you haven't changed a bit.
I know. I look the same. It's nice. But but I was very much into sonnets. I majored in 17th century metaphysical poetry. That's English poetry from the end of Shakespeare through the beginning of like King James.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some marvelous poets there. John Donne, George Herbert, William Shakespeare, Edmund Spenser. And these are the men that I studied. And so I like the sonnet style, and that's a 14-line poem with a rhyme scheme and a logic structure, an argument structure. And I began writing those in college, and I continued. And one of the first shocks of my life upon graduating was that if you publish a poem, you get $20 and 5 copies of the magazine. And that's, like, not really something that you can raise a family on.
Yeah.
So there went the fevered brow poet theory. Mm-hmm. However, I liked the form, and I liked doing it, so I just kept creating sonnets. And ideas would come along because all my life I've liked to read good literature. So I'm not much on the common stuff. Mm-hmm. I'll go through different eras.
Well, Daniel Steele is pained to hear this.
Well, anyway, it would lead to ideas. You know, reading makes you think. So mm-hmm. it would lead to some ideas, and I would come up with some thoughts. I was very much into music and jazz singers and mm-hmm. opera singers, and so I had some poems that were written about them. And then my new style is sort of tongue-in-cheek humor and very free verse, so there's no structure, mm-hmm. whereas, well, there is a structure, but...
not apparent.
But not as rigid as a sonnet. Mm-hmm. You can't have a 12-line sonnet or a 16-line sonnet, although there are a lot of American poets today who say that you can.
Oh, yeah.
I disagree with them. But, hey, they're professors, and I'm not, so what can I do?
All right. Well, would you favor us with a reading or two?
Sure. This is called Dog-Eared. I have a yellow lab, and we take them to the dog park, and it's a very interesting experience. Sex. You quicken. Jump up. You dog. Rex. Fido. When you say walk, or dog park, or dinner, dogs quicken. No thought, just like us. Rex, say hello to the nice young lady. Oh, my God, no, no, not there. Off! Sigh. Only with dogs. They smile all the time, except in rage, and do what they want, just like us. Oh, that I truly possess my dog's life view. No end, stretch, fetch, again, roll over. Always glad to see me.
Well, that resonates with me because you met young Rocky here when you came in a little while ago, and every description there fits him. He hasn't been fixed yet, so he's happy to see any girl dogs that we encounter.
Absolutely.
And not there, Rocky, not there.
It's quite embarrassing, but most of the people at the dog park are sort of acclimated to it.
Well, and we have this euphemism. The lipstick is out of the tube.
I'll have to propagate that down to Santa Clara County.
Rocky, settle down. Put the lipstick back. Okay, and one more, please.
Okay, this is Voyager 3. And in space news, NASA received signals from two old space travelers from beyond our planets yesterday. Launched in 1977, the two space travelers, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, are nearing the edge of our solar system, which they are expected to reach in about another 10 years. Me too. When they will break beyond into interstellar space. All in all, I'd rather be in Philadelphia again.
Lauren, it's great to have you here. Congratulations on being published.
Thank you so much.
And I want people again to go to your website, laurenfarber.com, L-A-W-R-E-N, not a Larry, he's a Lauren. And I really enjoyed what I've read of Portage, and I'm going to finish it because I got to get to the climax.
Exactly. Thanks for having me on, Peter.
My pleasure, Lauren. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Wash it down with a glass of organic wine. I'd be much obliged.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.